Today on the Inside Flap.
I just loved that job until I didn't love it.
Yeah.
And when I didn't love it, I said, I don't want to spend the rest of my life reviewing movies in which giant washing machines come to Earth to turn a giant motorcycle.
You've spent a lot of time with the character of Bob Lee Swagger, and I was curious, what do you think you have in common with Bob? You've sat with this character for a long time.
Well, yeah, I have a lot more not in common with him than in common. I mean, he's brave, I'm not. He's strong, I'm not. He's vigorous, I'm not. He actually, once in a while, gets off the sofa. I don't.
And again and again. This is one of those books that as I was listening to it, I literally couldn't stop. I would look for chores to do so I could just keep listening to it. I was grabbing the dog like, you know, hey, Nelson, let's go. It's time to go for a walk. And he's looking at me like, hey, guy, it's 110 degrees outside. I'm not going anywhere. I'm like, I don't care. I got to find out what happens.
The Inside Flap is available on demand every week on iTunes, Stitcher, the Google Play Store, and around the world on theinsideflap.com.
Podcasting live from Littleton, Colorado, this is the Inside Flap Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Dave Medicus, and welcome to the show. Seated over to my right, adjusting and fiddling with his new chair, can't seem to quite get it right, is Andrew Dowd.
Excelsior!
Yes, right into that mic, nice and hot. That is Andrew.
And he's punching the air.
Punching the air again. Punching the air.
Very nice.
Good to see.
Nice.
And to my left, that's Howdy. Laura Medicus. Howdy.
Yes.
So, thank you so much for joining us. This is The Inside Flap. And welcome to the show. We have a big show for you today. Coming up, a conversation with Stephen Hunter.
Woo!
Yeah, Pulitzer Prize-winning movie reviewer. Also, my personal favorite movie reviewer.
Mm-hmm.
His new book is called Game of Snipers. It's a new Bob Lee Swagger book. It's really good. I enjoyed it. We'll have that conversation for you in just a little bit. But first, quick story for you. You know, Andrew, Laura and I went to see the Avett Brothers a couple weeks ago at Red Rocks. Now,
who?
The Avett Brothers?
Yeah, play, no clue.
Let's see. This is their latest song here. It's called High Steppin'.
Still no clue.
This is good stuff right here. Now, if you're just hearing this for the first time, you might think it's a country band. And they seem to be a little more...
folk rock. I call them folk rock.
Folk rock, you think so?
Uh-huh, okay. Yeah. This is a lot of a country sound, though. Because when I first heard this, you came to the kitchen, Dave Medicus, and you said, what?
Like, what the hell are you doing?
More country? Because I had also been listening to maybe some early Dolly.
Maybe, something. But
I'd heard some early Dolly Parton.
This is their new song. So, you know, they come every summer. We go to see them. They play 3 sold-out shows at Red Rocks. We always go to check them out. I think this is our 4th straight year of seeing them there.
Mm-hmm.
Just a great place. Have you seen a concert at Red Rocks, Andrew?
I've seen a few, and but three sold out shows.
Yes.
I mean, that's quite a crowd.
Oh yeah, no, they're
really popular.
Really
group.
Popular. Not if you'd asked you.
Clearly
about
not,
them,
to but, Andrew. But
all right, Judd Apatow just did a documentary about them.
It's true. It's a good doc.
Check that out.
It's on HBO right now.
Yeah. So they come every year, and we see them. Great, great performers. Great energy. I mean, they always put on a fantastic show.
They do.
Well, almost always.
They do. This was not their fault.
Okay, let me just kind of walk you through what happened to us at the
concert. Partly their fault, but it, honestly, I would not blame the brothers.
Okay. I agree to disagree.
Okay.
So let me just say this, Andrew. I don't think I've waited in so many lines until we since the last time we were at Epcot Center 4 years ago. That's the last time I've waited in this many lines in my life.
Epcot was brutal.
So the first line was to get in, simply just driving our car up to the park.
You know? To Red Rocks, yeah.
Up to Red Rocks. So doors open at 6:30. We're going to get there early. We do a little tailgating there. Mm-hmm. We go to the park. It's Laura, it's Sylvia, and Laura's mother, Cindy.
We had a nice time.
Yeah, we had some chicken, some fried chicken, had some soda, a little pasta salad. You know, really, I picked out the olives. But other than that, you know, it was a delicious pasta salad. We're getting excited for the show. Now, this being Red Rocks, you know you're going to have a severe uphill walk. Basically, a small hike to get to the venue from that lot. We were in the lower lot, of course, because if you want to park in the upper lot near the actual venue, you have to arrive approximately 17 hours ahead of time.
We normally take a limousine.
Oh.
And it drops us off.
You know. But you don't get the tailgating experience with the limo.
No, we do not get That's the tailgating experience.
No, you're not tailgating.
Because we're down there.
The
we're with the masses,
this guy,
Andrew.
Fancy.
Everyone's out. Okay. They all have their lawn chairs out. They've got radios cranked.
Yeah,
people are smoking a few.
The heady aroma of marijuana is wafting across the parking lot.
But do you know, all these limos look alike. Do you know how hard it is to find your
true.
Limo?
Oh, that is true.
I mean, what a horrible.
My goodness. It's
awful. I do feel really sorry for you with that. That's true.
We have a nice little meal.
A lot of verifying license plates.
We hike up to the entrance. This time, I did not ruin my shorts. 2 years ago, I ate the fried chicken off of a napkin.
How did you ruin your shorts? That sounds so gross.
In my lap. And the grease from the chicken kind of soaked through the paper towel and seeped onto my shorts. And then when I took the napkin off my shorts, I looked down. I was like, okay, not going to wear these shorts ever again. But now I'm paper plate guy.
I would ruin my shorts as the next drop for you, Dave Medicus.
Paper plate guy. Sure, we'll make a note of that.
So I think we need a Ron Burgundy quote now. Stay classy, San Diego.
Well, that was 2 years ago. This year, no problem. We hike up to the line, the actual line now to get into the concert. It takes us about 20 minutes just to hike up the hill to get to the line. And we get our position. Now, it's about 6 o'clock at this point. Doors are going to open at 6. I'm very excited because we've got a great position.
We had a great position. You
know, not too far back. We're just going to wait about 30 minutes. Doors are going to open and boom, we got a straight shot to it. We'll grab a t-shirt. We'll find our seats and watch the opener as the sun sets over Red Rocks. What more could you ask for?
So, Dave, describe Red Rocks a little bit, because maybe not everybody has been to Red Rocks. They have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, it's a world-famous venue, right?
If you hop on YouTube and just Google any concert at Red Rocks, it's just absolutely
beautiful.
Had
massive, a very famous, foggy, rainy concert.
John Tesh also had
John
a very
Tesh
famous
did have
concert.
A famous
So it is a natural...
Huge slabs of natural red rock.
Yeah, so natural rock amphitheater, Red Rock, beautiful views... you can see the stars, straight up for the concert. And the acoustics are amazing there.
Yeah, well, these red rocks form giant walls on either side. And when the guy who built the arena about 100 years ago, he found the place. He said this would make a perfect location for an amphitheater. And all he had to do was build in the seats. And everything else was already in place. It had a beautiful rock backdrop, the two huge giant
it's really
rocks
stunning.
On either
yeah.
side of the seating area. Absolutely.
I mean, we met
it holds about 20,000 people.
That were there from Canada.
Yeah, they drove from, or they flew down from.
Just to see this concert at Red Rocks.
At Red Rocks, yeah.
Actually, they were going to be there for all 3 nights. They had tickets for all 3 nights.
That's right. Wow. Hopefully,
crazy Ava Brother fans. Canadian. Crazy. Crazy Canadians.
Well, so we're waiting in line there. Then all of a sudden, with about 15 minutes to go before the doors open, we hear... from behind the mountains in front of us, what starts rolling in are these dark, ominous clouds. I mean, these clouds are darker than that Mike Knowles 10 Men book I reviewed last week. Okay, these suckers are severely dark. But it's 6:30, and I figure, well, if we can get in before the rain starts, and we're hearing the thunder overhead, of course, but if we can just get in before the rain starts, we'll be fine. They've got a little museum inside, a little hall of fame for and a little picture gallery in an indoor location in the venue. If we can just get inside, we'll be fine.
We can hunker in there.
So now it's 6:35, and the line is at a standstill. Nobody's entering the arena. We're going nowhere. Then it's 6:40, and then all of a sudden, there's this guy who walks around in an orange vest, and he's shouting at us, "Ladies and gentlemen, there is severe weather in the area. We are advising you to get into your vehicles until the weather passes. Thank you." And then, right on cue again, we hear... So now, the dilemma is, It's not raining yet, but it's thundering. We don't see, we see lightning off in the distance. It's not right nearby.
It's fairly near.
So
I
the
thought
question
it was.
Is,
it seemed fairly near to me.
Do we?
I didn't feel unsafe though.
Stay in line, risk getting rained on. And I had Laura and Cindy and Sylvia had raincoats. I had
also
a,
you may have forgotten
a poncho.
It was raining.
Oh, it did rain a little bit while we were
raincoat raincoat true, on.
Yes.
It, we all had was, our raincoats
okay.
on.
Very, very.
You had a poncho that you
that's
probably
true.
Pretty much ruined. Was oh, it, no, you hadn't taken it out at that point.
No, I was saving it because it wasn't raining. It was sprinkling a little bit. Mm. Now, at a certain point, the clouds get so dark, and now it's about 7:30. Now, we've been waiting in line for an hour. And I said, well, that's these clouds are too dark. Let's get back to the truck. So we head back down the old dusty trail to the truck. And literally seconds after we get inside the truck, what happens?
Hail.
Massive hailstorm. Torrential rain.
Oh, wow.
Thunder comes in.
I bet you worked that mixing board.
And I'm like, yes, we made it. You know, and for a second there, we're pretty happy because we did it. We
beat
the weather.
Not even for a second. We felt super
yeah,
pleased with ourselves.
We were high-fiving and big smiles because we had beaten, we had bucked the system. But then we realized, well, we're still in the truck. We've literally done a big circle, and it's an hour and a half later, maybe 2 hours later at this point, and we've just done a big circle, and we're back sitting in the truck. So the rain passes about 30 minutes later. We venture back up towards the entrance. Now we can't even start the uphill section of our hike because that's now where the line begins. Like we can't even see the upper parking lot at this point. So we wait in that line for about 20 minutes. We advance about 50 feet and climb about 10 steps up. And then all of a sudden a guy from below is shouting, hey, the line at the south entrance is shorter. Try the south entrance. So, turn around, head down. We schlep down to the south entrance, and then finally, we start to get moving one step at a time. About 200 steps later, we finally arrive at the gate to get into the concert. So, it's now about 9 o'clock. Now, let me remind you, we arrived at Red Rocks around 6 o'clock. So it's been 3 hours already and haven't seen any musicians at all, except for maybe a few people who were smoking some weed in the parking lot.
When we entered, the opening act was finishing.
Yes. So we get up to our row, climb a bunch of more seats, because Red Rocks is nothing but steps. So get up about 3/4 the way up. Just as we're getting ready to go into our row.
Not great seats.
Sylvia goes, I'm hungry. So now we have to get Sylvia some food because, of course, she's hungry. So Laura and Cindy take their seats. I say, no problem. I got it. I'll just run Sylvia up to the concessions at the top. We'll grab her some pizza. We'll pop right back down in time for the first song. So we climb the additional 150 steps to get to the concessions. And this area now is wall-to-wall people. And I thought that we might have been all done with the lines. no such luck. The line at the pizza concession place was out of control. So, but she's tired. She's hungry. So we're gonna get a little pizza. So we wait in line, get the pizza. Of course, they're all out of boxes, so they put it on this little plate. We turn around to walk back to our seats, and I say to Sylvia, "I say, Syl, it's extremely crowded. Please hold on to your pizza with both hands." And of course, she's giving me attitude like, I got it, no problem. I said, it's very crowded. Please hold on to it with both hands. So we take about 2.5 steps back towards our seats when before you can say Red Rocks, Sylvia's pizza is lying face down on the concrete walkway. So immediately out of my mouth tumbles some words that I immediately regret, and it's back to the line. Wait in line for another 15 minutes before we finally get to order. And by the way, Red Rocks, how about you don't card every single person in line who orders a beer? Now, this is why the line was taking so long to advance, because anybody who orders a beer there, everybody gets carded. People in their 60s were getting carded. And every time, it's the same. The person's like, what? Why do you want to see my ID? Why do you need to see my ID? I'm 85 years old. Oh, sorry, we have to see everybody's. I don't have an ID. Well, let me check my pocket. Maybe it's in my... Sorry, so we need to see an...
Because not everyone's going to bring their ID because it's a hassle just to walk up all those stairs. If you're like us, Andrew, and we don't rent the limo.
Right, of course. So the line moves at a glacial pace. We finally get up there.
Got in trouble.
Again, this time we get...
it's also dark at this point.
Oh, it's been dark.
Yeah, it's dark.
I shell out another $20 for a small cheese pizza and
let me guess,
to head back to our seats.
At this point, you are going to carry the pizza down the steps.
Well, hey, they had boxes. All of a sudden, miraculously, they've got boxes. So, finally, we start to head back down, and of course, as soon as we start back to head down, we hear the band starts.
Oh, yeah.
You know. Oh, and meanwhile, while I'm in line waiting for the pizza, Laura's constantly texting me, "Where are you? What's going on?
I didn't know why the show was about to start.
People are sitting in your seats. You better get down here."
It took a half an hour. I mean, it literally took you at least a half an hour.
Yeah, tell me about it. I was the one in line.
And I didn't know what was going on.
Absolutely.
And the
horrendous
other part about Red Rocks that is a little stressful is that...
it's just benches.
It's benches. So there's no necessarily designated seat.
No.
And, like, they're generous benches. So really, you probably could fit two people on one ticketed seat.
Well, one
and
three quarters.
I have been guilty... I used to be in my youth a huge Tori Amos fan.
Oh, yeah.
And I had a friend who got first row tickets at this Tori Amos Red Rock concert, and he dragged Dave and I down to the first row to be
with them.
So it was three people on one ticket, and I've done that before. So, yes, Andrew.
Now, I have to say, Dave and Laura, you are really selling the Red Rocks experience.
Oh, let me tell you, I'm not done yet.
You haven't finished.
Just wait.
It's not finished.
Just wait.
I apologize for doing that, Dave. I felt so stressed out. I had so many people coming and trying to take your seat. And then I finally had the one people who stayed. They just stayed.
No, they just parked out.
They looked at me. I was like, hey, you know, these seats are taken. They're coming. And they're like, oh, we'll move when they get back. And I'm thinking, no, you won't.
Well, they actually did. They were very nice.
They didn't move. But it was plenty of room.
They slid
it didn't matter
a little bit.
Ultimately, because of the situation, it did not matter.
So finally, we got down. It's now about 9:30. The Avett Brothers came out. Sounded great. They played.
High energy.
Oh, man. They literally played for how long? Maybe about 10 minutes.
10 minutes.
Before they leave the stage, a woman comes from backstage and says, "Ladies and gentlemen, due to severe weather in the area, we advise you to return to your cars or seek shelter elsewhere." I mean, the crowd they're booing. Everybody's upset because it's not raining right now. It's just a little bit of the old in the background. But from what we've been through so far, you know, we didn't care.
Now, to their defense, the first time I went to go to a concert there.
I know, we were with you, Andrew.
Yeah, yes. And basically somebody was struck by lightning and killed.
Matthew Winter's Park.
At the park next to Red Rocks. And Red Rocks had lost their power. I don't know if you remember that, because lightning struck Red Rocks.
And they canceled the concert.
Yeah.
So it was that ABBA tribute band.
I do.
Fine. Well, you got the Avett Brothers over here, and then you got the ABBA tribute band over here. Somewhere in the middle, the truth can be found.
I will say, though, in the back of my head was that story, because I remember vividly, you know, someone died. And,
so we know the drill. So this time, we don't have to go all the way back to the truck. We race to the indoor, a little museum area.
We get underground, basically.
We get underground. So we're down there for about 30 minutes.
Until they tell us.
Finally, we get the all clear. Get back to our seats.
It's 10 o'clock at night.
Now, at least 10 o'clock, if not 10:30. We've heard maybe three songs at this point. So then we get back to our seats.
We heard like two.
The brothers start playing again. And then now what happens, of course, we get a steady.
It was
cold.
Andrew, I mean, soaked.
Cold.
I had water repellent is what I found out. It wasn't a waterproof rain jacket that I had. It was a water repellent.
Yeah.
Rain jacket.
And basically, I whipped out this poncho, and it was one of those El Cheapo ponchos that you can get.
Dave broke his poncho immediately. I don't know how you did it.
It was It's basically like a piece of saran wrap over top of myself.
And he immediately broke it.
It was absolutely ridiculous. It was freezing cold. I had to tuck my arms inside my short sleeve shirt, huddle in there for warmth.
Yeah.
The boys, and now you would think.
That's true. This is
you
it.
Would think.
Now this
cold,
is, here, wait, wait, wait.
Yes,
hang on.
Yes.
So up until now, nothing has been the fault of the Aver brothers. Just want to point that out.
No, no, that's true.
Up until now.
Up until now. Up until at this point, everything was out of their control.
No fault of theirs.
Well, and even they were acknowledging, thank you for being
you.
Here. We know it's hard for you. We know how hard it is out there. We see you suffering.
Yeah, that's true.
So you would think maybe they'd play some up-tempo song, something to get us up on our feet and moving around and dancing, but no, every single slow song in their catalog
they brought out all the slow songs.
Every single one.
And they're a band, Andrew, since you don't know them.
Oh, yeah, listen
to
this.
They do a different, no, that's not my point.
Ah.
But that is a good point. But they do a different set list every night.
Yeah, there's no...
They don't have a set list that's set in stone.
They have to switch it up.
Because they've got dancers and lights. They don't have that.
No, they can switch it up. They can certainly play whatever they want.
But,
and they can play up-tempo when they want. Listen to this. They got many, many up-tempo songs. But no, every single slow song they had, they played. Here, listen to this one.
These things more I wish I had not.
This is an example of one of the songs they were playing. I mean, come on. Molasses is faster than the tempo of these songs.
And then the problem is, I'd like to see them again, but I don't know if I can do it next time.
I mean, how can you justify the price when you're beholden to the weather?
So what are
you're
the
at the mercy.
What are the tickets?
I don't remember.
They're not $20.
$60 a seat, something
probably,
like that.
Yeah.
60, 70,
yeah.
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah,
with the Ticketmaster charges and all that, probably $80 a pop. Something like that. But
they weren't crazy expensive, but they weren't cheap either.
Yeah. We got I think what time do we get home? Oh, you know what? You know what? I don't know what they were playing.
In the morning
but
or
this
so.
Is the song that I kept hearing in my mind.
I would have liked to have heard that song, actually.
Wow. That was the song that was running over and over in my
They did
mind.
Do a nice cover of Operator by Jim Croce.
Did they?
Another slow song.
I wouldn't have noticed.
Another slow song.
I was being rained on and shivering uncontrollably.
Yeah, I love Jim Croce. I'd like to hear that one.
It was a beautiful cover.
It was nice. It sounded much nicer last year when they did the exact same cover in nicer weather.
Yeah, but yes, it's fine. We no reason to dicker over small things.
I don't think we didn't even make it.
It was a very bad experience.
To the curtain call, we did not. They did.
It made me rethink the Red Rocks experience.
They were getting ready to do a third post callback.
It was a slow song. It was a beautiful song.
Another slow one, and we were like,
beautiful song called "No Hard Feelings."
That's it.
It's in the Judd Apatow documentary. It's beautiful.
There were some hard feelings on this guy's part.
I had some hard feelings.
Yeah, we all had some hard feelings.
I love the Aver Brothers.
As we slumped,
I love them.
Defeated, back to our truck, utterly demoralized.
I wonder about the Canadian couple, but I guess the other two nights I don't think it rained here, so they were fine.
Who knows? I think we dropped Cindy off this time. Oh, this was 2 years ago, I think, when we dropped her off.
Oh, this was funny. Yeah.
Tom, Laura's father, had gone to bed. And when he goes to bed, I mean, he puts the house in lockdown mode.
Yeah.
He unplugs his cell phone, apparently, cranks up the white noise, maybe puts some earbuds on, blindfold.
Because
Cindy didn't have her house key with her.
And he'd locked every single entry point to the home.
Yeah, they're over in Golden. We're banging on every door in the house, knocking on the window.
Even, she knew the garage code. That door inside of the garage was locked.
The door to the house inside the garage was locked.
Yeah.
That was 2 years ago.
And you wonder where I get my obsessions from.
So, but she remembered to bring her key this time. We dropped her off and got home around 1 o'clock.
Yeah.
And then I think I got warm.
You know, I haven't talked to her about it.
Next day.
But I imagine she has a similar, I don't know if I want to go back to Red Rocks anytime soon kind of feeling.
It certainly makes it difficult when you have an experience like that.
Yeah. Yep.
Yep. Good times. Laura, how was your week?
Or just spring for the limo next time.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's not going to stop it from raining on us at the concert.
No, but you're just steps away from your nice warm limo.
That's true.
With the bar and everything, you know.
That's true.
Yeah.
Great. Well, if you'd like to pitch into the
We need to invite Andrew
fund.
Dowd next time.
Ah, that's it.
That's what I'm hearing, Dave Medicus.
That's the ticket.
Well, actually, I thought maybe I was kind of curious about Andrew, if Andrew had a had a story for us.
Well, you heard about Fernando.
Yes.
And the tree.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, yes. Well documented on the show. The man who cut down the tree, was hired by the neighbor to cut down one of their trees.
Hired by the neighbors.
Ended up...
Andrew's wife, who just had surgery and could not, should not, I guess she could, should not lift her arms above her shoulders,
mm-hmm.
probably even her waist, trying to get this man's attention, who's climbed up 80 foot
hacked
and is
all
sawing
the limbs
off
of
his pine tree.
Yes. So I found out since then that my neighbor had sent this guy a picture of the tree he wanted cut down originally next to his trampoline.
Oh.
I mean, and all he had to do was look at that picture, you know, to be sure he's cutting down the right tree. So there really is, there's absolutely no...
Was this the principal?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I know
and
them.
So in any event,
wow.
I had a birthday this last weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And so Fernando... was
happy birthday,
well,
Andrew.
Yes, happy
thank
birthday.
You. Mm-hmm. Fernando was supposed to show up 3 weeks ago.
That's right. And he didn't.
And he didn't.
Said he was going to chop it down for free since he's already
basically killed
the
tree. And then he tried to charge him
$500.
Tried to charge,
and we said, And so we negotiated that he would just cut it down, leave it in small pieces, and I would do the cleanup.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the tree would be down. It would be safely down, would no longer be a hazard.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a no-show 3 weeks later, and I'm kind of thinking good riddance at this point.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm okay if I never see Fernando, the drunken tree guy again.
Yeah.
The drunken arborist.
So here it is, my birthday weekend.
Uh-huh.
My wife and I, we are at Caesar's Palace.
Mm-hmm.
I'm minutes away from heading into my 80-minute deep tissue massage at the Caesar's spa.
Yeah, boy!
Sure. Yes.
And I get a text message from Fernando.
Ooh. Oh, no. Well, that's going to ruin the mood.
And he's like, and he basically says, I'm right around the corner.
Ugh.
Now, the baby's, the nanny is essentially home with my daughter.
Right.
And so I'm like, well, what do you mean? He's like, I'll be there in 10 minutes. And so, so basically I text the nanny. And
did fear go through your heart?
Well, not fear.
Anxiety?
Anxiety, okay. Concern. And
anxiety.
So, and so
yeah.
I text the nanny. lock up the dogs. Double lock all the doors.
Hide the kids
because the drunken tree.
Yeah,
guy
make sure Mary Kate's inside.
Yeah, is going to be there in 10 minutes.
Duck behind the duck underneath the windows.
And so I warn her, and then I gave her the warning.
That's great.
Then I call her.
Yeah,
and I say he's going to be showing up any minute. And I said, now be careful because he's probably drunk.
Wow.
And so.
What does this girl say back to you?
Well, you know, and I can probably show you the text message.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And Dave can read the exchange here.
Oh, she responds with the laughing, crying emoji and says...
What does she say?
He is 100% drunk.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh no!
Hey, hand me that phone. Can
oh,
I see?
Oh no, Fernando!
So this is no exaggeration. This is no exaggeration at all.
I thought maybe you were just playing this up, but no. Clearly,
oh my gosh.
This guy might want to check into rehab.
So
we might need to do a little intervention.
Do some intervention.
And I actually do have a plan.
Something bad is going to happen
to try and help Fernando.
Something bad is going to happen to him if he doesn't get help.
Because we actually have a mutual friend.
That you have a mutual friend with Fernando?
We do.
Oh, you and I do.
Not a mutual friend, but we have a mutual friend who actually belongs to a group of people that actually helps, Latinos that have substance abuse.
Oh, I know
abuse.
Who this is. Okay.
And
so
I actually do want to put a call in and to see if somebody can go have a discussion with Fernando.
Yeah, this guy should not be running around with chainsaws in this condition.
No. I mean,
he's going to die.
Well, or he's going to hurt somebody.
And that's what it says as far as the law. So So the bottom line is,
like, this is like we're laughing, but
hey guys, where's the tree? What's going on? Hey, what's up? I got a new chainsaw. What do you think? Just freshly lubed up. Yeah. What do you think, I chopped down two trees for the price of one. What do you think?
Fernando. So the bottom line is, nothing got cut down on Sunday, but he did come back Monday, mostly sober. I stayed home from work.
So what didn't he? Why didn't he do it on Sunday?
He said he was too tired.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah. And so maybe he realized he was in
no shape to climb that tree.
A
little self-awareness. That's
so
good.
So the good news is he came on Monday. I stayed home from work to lock things down.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He cut the tree down. He safely left.
Okay.
And, I'm hoping that's the end of the story. I'm hoping.
Wow.
Let's hope so.
And Fernando's.
Well, let's hope the end of the story is that you find a little help for Fernando.
No, and we're definitely going to make the attempt.
That's a great idea.
That's all you can do.
Andrew, that's a great idea.
Yeah, that's great.
Sleep better at night knowing that.
Wow, that is insane. Wow. Well, that the resolution on that story did not disappoint. Did not disappoint.
No, it didn't. I'm actually shocked because when you can make jokes about the drunken arborist.
Yeah.
I didn't really think it was that true, though.
No.
I thought maybe he was just absent-minded.
100% drunk.
Or, like, not a great businessman. But no, he's got a...
Well, wow. It was a Sunday. I mean, his defense, it is a Sunday, you know. I think, though...
No defense there. If it's a Sunday and you're drinking, don't go out and cut down a tree.
That's true.
What do you think this is, Alaska?
He did probably get in his truck and drunk drove home. So there's that, too.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Well, Laura.
So Dave Medicus.
Yes, how
speaking
was your
of drunk driving home,
yeah.
We are headed to Ireland and mm-hmm. England.
What are you saying about the Irish and the English?
I'm saying nothing about them at all.
Speaking of drunk driving, we're headed to Ireland.
I'm half Irish. O'Dowd.
Yeah, you're wearing
the O'Dowds.
Look at that. You got a shamrock on your shirt.
He has a shamrock
right
on. Mm-hmm.
Rocking some Ravens gear.
Ladies, you should see it.
Some green Ravens gear.
So we're getting ready to go on a long plane ride. And I had heard something recently that I'm not a very nervous flyer, really. Like, I have a lot of anxiety about a lot of things in my life, but flying isn't necessarily one of them. But I can't stop thinking about this. You know how when they dim the lights when you're, if you fly at night or in the evening, the lights on the airplane get dim during takeoff? Have you noticed Andrew and Dave? Mm-hmm. It's like a good
Absolutely.
Time to kind of sleep or whatever.
Right.
I always thought it was courtesy.
Yeah, I thought they were just kind of, setting the mood.
They do that so that your eyes are adjusted to the dark. So if you go into a crash situation, you are better able to see to get out of the airplane.
Really?
Yes.
So they're anticipating a crash because
to help your eyes adjust to the gloom so that if, like, I guess it was probably fairly common if you're going to crash, that probably would happen during takeoff or landing. Those are the trickier situations there.
Right. Yeah.
And that's what they do.
Wow.
And because of that, now I got like a creepy...
Well, now every time they dim the lights, now all I'm going to be thinking about is the plane crashing.
That's what
and
I'm
that's why
think
they
do.
Okay,
too.
Guys, just in case a plane crashes, we're going to go ahead and dim these lights, okay?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it always seemed like the courtesy thing. And I'd be like, oh, now's my sleepy time.
Yeah,
it's not. It's not. It's safety.
You vet that research. Where did you get that information from?
The radio. Okay. I heard on the radio. I did Google it though.
Yeah.
Before I decided to mention this, just in case, and I did see it online, but I don't remember what online forum.
All right. Okay.
Yeah.
So that way you can see over the flames and the explosions.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right, Andrew. Okay. You're better able to react with flying shrapnel coming at you.
Okay.
That's true. Yeah, we are taking that trip coming up, and I had to call. I've been making these little arrangements. We're doing some tours and stuff like that while we're going to be over there. So luckily, now everything is online. So you just go there, click. We'll be on these days. Click. Let me buy these tickets. Click.
Stuff. Yeah.
Unfortunately, so we're going to Ireland.
Oh my gosh, this is funny.
This little place where they got some caves down there and a little boat ride underneath the water.
We'll be in County Cavan, so Cavan Caves, and they have these like.
Oh, that's why I didn't put
that
together.
Get that?
Oh,
my
I'm an
gosh.
Idiot.
Okay. All right. Check out the big brain on.
In any case, on their website, I wanted to reserve some tickets for the tour. It says, please call this number to reserve your tickets. Now, immediately I start sweating and I check three other websites to make sure that there's no possible way I can order these tickets online. But unfortunately, no, I've got a call.
He's to call Ireland.
I'm nervous because I'm afraid that I'm not going to be able to understand. Well, first of all, I don't like calling places anyway. If I can do it online, I'm going to do it. I don't like
Dave
talking
to people.
Dave has
like a stammering problem when he gets on the
when
phone.
When the waiter
people.
Comes over, I can I?
It's
hey,
terrible.
I like to, if you, what is
oh,
your,
the worst.
I got, I don't know why I get, you,
know. You know, you just can't make this stuff up.
No. I mean, he does. He has a stammering
you
problem.
You can't shut him up normally.
No, it's so weird. And he's not shy, Andrew. He's not a shy person.
I think I'm just trying to.
He turns into a shy, introverted stammerer. It's like Hugh Grant has suddenly appeared next to me.
So.
I wish. I'm just kidding.
I don't know why that happens, but it does.
It
so
does,
I'm very,
yeah.
very nervous. In fact, I just had to call Wells Fargo to tell him.
The thing
and
is,
I got
Sylvia
just
and
about
I
that.
Get nervous. Like when you go to order at a table, I think she does too. I know I do. I get a little like anxiety for you.
Well, I'm glad I know that. It's going to make me feel real secure next
and
time
I,
we go
like,
to a restaurant.
And I could order for you, but that would be weird.
So I call this. First of all, it takes me three times just to dial to Ireland because it's got like a little plus symbol. It's got some zeros there. I don't know. Did you know on the iPhone you have to hold down on the zero to make the plus symbol appear?
I did not know that.
That's something I had to find out. And so I finally get through to Ireland and... the woman picks up and I hear, I'm figuring she's just saying the name of the establishment. And so I say, yes, we'd like to reserve tickets to your tour for the caves. And she says, oh, that'd be good. Would you like to be doing it? and I said, what you're always supposed to do when you don't understand. I said, yep.
And then, also, I'm looking at Dave while this is happening, and I can hear an Irish woman's voice, and I heard she said something that was fairly long.
Very, very long.
And Dave looks at me, and he had just sheer panic in your eyes, and then you just go, yep.
So there's another long silence, and I think at this point she processes the fact that I'm American, because when she comes back to me, it's, what days will you be staying? You know, she's talking to me
like
very,
slow.
Like I'm a first grader now, and she's got to dumb it down. So, but that's what she had to do. And the rest of the conversation was just fine. In fact,
except you thought she asked for your first name and gave her Dave, never asked for anything else. And then you realized it was your surname.
She asked for my surname, and I thought
we don't really say over here
your first name. And I'm like, Dave. She never asked for my last name after that. And then I gave her my credit card number too fast. And she, hold on a wee minute here, which was cool. It was kind of cool when she said a wee minute. Mm-hmm.
So between you and Chevy Chase, you're really giving Americans a good name overseas.
That's true.
Absolutely.
So any Irish listeners, when you listen to this, we will be in your neck of the woods. And if you hear Americans flailing about.
That's right.
We are renting kayaks also, which we swear we'd never do again. But yet again, another trip, we're renting kayaks.
Third time's a charm. Uh-huh. Third time's a charm. Hopefully we won't get beat up, upended,
so
dumped into
commotion.
The ocean. It looks like calm waters, so we should be just fine.
Just look kindly on us, please.
I think George and Mary Medicus are going to leave you guys in the dust for the kayaks.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, they're not coming.
They're
on
not
us.
Coming.
Oh, they're not on the trip.
Oh, no. No.
Just Laura,
but yes,
Sylvia,
they would leave
myself,
us on the dust. That's true.
And Cindy is coming as well.
My mom.
That's right. And speaking of kayaking, let's go ahead and paddle on over to our interview with Stephen Hunter. Quick heads up, though. He was a great guest. He was fantastic.
Yes. So
Loved talking to him. The quality
of information that you'll hear from Stephen Hunter
is fantastic.
Who is an awesome man. Is fantastic, but the sound quality is not ideal.
Unfortunately, Stephen was not accessible to Skype, so we had to do it over a cell phone, and the quality is not great.
I'm sure we are at fault, not Stephen Hunter. I'm sure it was on our end.
Yeah, I'm sure it was our fault, clearly, but. Really, really a great conversation. Enjoy
Listen
talking
to, it.
To him.
Yeah. Just know that there's great information.
It's not horrendous. It's not horrendous quality, but it's
true.
Not the best.
It's not it's what not we're used best. To. Yeah.
So anyway.
But he's worth it.
He's fantastic.
Yes.
Very funny guy. Quite a character.
Yes.
Here he is. Here's Stephen Hunter.
I see
Cool. So listen, I really, really enjoyed your new book, Game of Snipers. I love the character of Janet, this woman who's just hell-bent on vengeance and really risks her life in the pursuit of the man who killed her son in Baghdad. What inspired you to write this one?
In this case, I decided, you know, these people have been buying these books for years. Let's pay attention to them. So the question I asked myself was, what did they want the most? And the answer I came up with was, they want to see Bob the Nailer nail. They want to see him take a big shot for all the marbles under coming from fire with the clock ticking down. So I knew that would be the climax. And if that's the climax, that raises questions. And I have to answer the questions. Who would the target be? Well, I mean, I knew he would be a counter sniper. That is to say, he would be shooting at another sniper who was shooting at a certain target. So who would the target be? If he was the target, why would they want to kill him? If they wanted to kill him, who would they recruit to do the job? And on backwards through the book. And in the end, I just kept asking myself questions backwards, finally coming to the first chapter where the whole thing is set up by the appearance of Janet. And so I plotted it backwards. Fortunately for all of us, I wrote it forward. And, I'm pleased. I think it makes sense. I don't know. Maybe I'll try to read it backwards sometime. Anyway, it's a very straightforward story, despite my convoluted telling of the writing it. And, I didn't want to make it too complicated. I wanted you to always know where you were in the plot. You always know where the good guys are. You always know where the bad guys are. You always know where they are in relationship to each other and whether they're drawing closer or drawing further apart. And I think that kind of clarity is very helpful for this sort of book.
For sure. And you must have been doing something right in thinking backwards, because it kept me up till after 1 o'clock in the morning, which is way past my bedtime reading it. So kudos to that. And I'd be needing some of that sleep back. But one thing I really loved in the book, you have a Ain't the Beer Cold Chuck Thompson reference in the book that literally had me jumping off my couch and doing fist pumps and mule kicks in the air.
See, that's just part of the culture of Baltimore. And, it just came out spontaneously. And when I put it in there, later I caught it and I thought, yes, that's a good idea. But I kept waiting for someone else to tell me it was wasn't such a good idea. And no one ever did. So it stayed in. And congratulations, you just justified it, so now I feel really good about it.
Oh, yeah. I leaped off the couch when I read it. I was like, yes, love Chuck Thompson. No, that was great.
And you've spent a lot of time with the character of Bob Lee Swagger, and I was curious, what do you think you have in common with Bob? You've sat with this character for a long time.
Well, yeah, I have a lot more not in common than in common. What I don't have, I mean, he's brave, I'm not. He's strong, I'm not. He's vigorous, I'm not. He actually, once in a while, gets off the sofa. I don't. He's sort of an ideal 73-year-old man.
Yeah, he really is,
I'm an actual 73-year-old man. Yeah, I have probably been guilty of letting a lot of my feelings and thoughts creep into him. Mm-hmm. So he's no longer an independent character. He's sort of a unofficial spokesman for me. And I hope that makes him interesting, but I don't know. I do a lot of this stuff spontaneously. Where it comes from, I don't know. If it feels right, I leave it. If it doesn't feel right or if someone makes a stink, I take it out. And in that way, we progress and we produce a book every couple of years.
Nice.
Well, after reading the book, I have to ask you this question. Do you believe that Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone gunsman?
That's a very good question, and it certainly is a question raised by the third bullet. Here's my policy answer on it. I believe he probably did it. Mm-hmm. I believe that the likelihood is about 97%.
Right.
However, what I try to do in the third bullet was come up with a logical, feasible, alternative explanation. And there's no physical reason, there's no law of physics or coincidence or happenstance that makes the thesis that I came up with impossible. It could have happened. Everything, you know, I was turned off by, and in some sense, what motivated me to write that book was that I was so annoyed that the conspiratorial theories were so absurdly gigantic, they couldn't have possibly happened.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
They were just insane.
Yeah.
And so I tried to think, how could this have happened? Mm-hmm. And my first decision was not, I mean, it's just not fair to say, oh, the Warren Commission was part of the cover-up. So obviously, everything it said was junk. Well, no, everything it said was right. So what I tried to do in that book was preserve the main findings of the Warren Commission, but find other explanations for why that happened. In other words, it didn't have to happen the way our inspector thought it happened. It could have happened another way without violating any of the laws of physics. The one bullet theory is a brilliant theory, but it didn't, it didn't have to stop there. Something else could have happened reasonably, I thought, and that's what I was arguing in that book. Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, yeah, there certainly doesn't have to be literal magic in a magic bullet, right? but let's talk.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you've won the Pulitzer Prize for movie reviewing, which is awesome. I think that leaps you above H.L. Mencken in Baltimore
mythology,
of course. And I know I read your reviews in the Baltimore Sun. They were required reading in my household. I believe the same can be said for Laura here.
Yeah.
You know, we wouldn't go to a movie. We would not go to a movie
this
until we knew what Stephen Hunter said about the movie.
Oh, how nice to hear. I mean, that's really so long ago, it's all but forgotten. But I was,
not
in fact,
me.
A film critic of the Sun for 16 years.
Yeah.
And I feel, I'm not going to say I'm a genius, but I will tell you this, I really did take that job seriously and work it hard. Yeah. And I gave it my best every single day. And when now and again it is remembered, is very, very pleasing to me. So I'm a happy boy.
That's awesome. Nice. Well, yeah, I'll never forget where I was. I was sitting in my living room reading the Baltimore Sun, your review of Mike Lee's Naked. I'm on the eastern shore of Maryland. I dropped the paper, drove over an hour to get up to the Charles so I could see that movie, and it's now one of my favorite movies of all time, and Mike Leigh is my favorite director, and I mean, that's all because of you and your review, so yeah, all I can say is thank you. I don't know what to say, but...
I am glad I proved useful.
I'm going to second Dave's. I was a teenager, and I read your reviews. My mom and I would talk about it. It was the first thing on a Friday. Did you see Stephen Hunter's reviews? And also because of your reviews, I saw things I would never have gone to see. And you opened my eyes really to the possibilities of film. And I was curious, do you hear that a lot from people? It's like a golden age of movie reviewers back then.
Well, I agree with you. And I would say that ours is no longer a golden age.
No,
of
no.
And I loved being in movie room. And part of that is because it's no longer a golden age of movies.
Yeah.
And it's hard to have one without the other.
That's true.
And I just loved that job until I didn't love it.
Yeah.
And when I didn't love it, I said, you know, this is not, I don't want to spend the rest of my life reviewing movies in which giant washing machines come to Earth and turn a giant motorcycle. You know? There's got to be something
else. Better.
But our clothes have never been whiter.
Yeah.
Oh, that's.
Well, I took pride in my writing of those reviews. I mean, that to me, the point of the exercise wasn't to be right about the movie, but to write a really good piece in really sturdy English prose, and that was what I took I took pride in.
Yes, well, it shows, and
it's memorable. I mean, I still remember reading those, and I remember the films that I read or that I saw. You know, driving down to the Senator. Mm-hmm. Where I lived and seeing them. Yeah, it was great.
What do you think about the Rotten Tomatoes website?
You know, I don't pay as much attention to modern films since I've left the business. Mostly I look at stuff on Netflix and I look at stuff on Prime Video or I look at stuff on pay-per-view. I almost never go to the movie theater when I see a movie, you know, a year after it's been released and it's provoked me, then I will check out the reviews to see what other people said. So I take more, I'm much more interested, I know this sounds snobbish, but I'm much more interested in professional film criticism than I am in Rotten Tomatoes and Amazon and stuff like that.
Right.
I mean, I like the democratization of the voices, but I still have a place in my heart for the professionalism of voices. And that's what I tried to offer, and that's what, to this day, I prefer.
Cool. How did you get your start out in the newspaper business? I'm assuming you don't just show up and say, hey, I want to review movies. Where do I sign up? How did it work for you?
Well, I just sort of bumble along and do the best I can. I don't have any real plans. It's pretty much been, everything has been improvised and accidental. And I've had some opportunities that I could not have anticipated, I could not have planned on. But when they arrived, I was not stupid, and so I took them. And some lives happen in certain ways and not in others. And to this day, I can't explain much of it. Hmm.
It seems like, did you always want to be a writer? And did you first think, you know, as a boy, that maybe I could write books?
Yes, I always wanted to be a writer. I was very lucky in that I had a very good public education in the 50s. In Evanston, Illinois, and I was very lucky in the for six of my first 7 years in school, teachers would call me out and tell me that I had a flair for writing, and that was, believe me, the only flair I had. I was a lousy athlete, I was ugly, I was a crybaby, coward. I was a thief. Well, I'm overselling, obviously. You know, I was just, you know, I was not an impressive child.
Right.
But I always got that praise. And that was so, so important to me because it gave me something I had confidence in.
Yeah.
It allowed me to define myself in a certain way. That praise followed me all the way through high school and college.
Wow.
And I hate to think of what it would have happened to me had the teachers been too busy, the classes too big, the disruptions too intense, the budget too low, for them to have paid that little tiny bit of special attention to me. I don't know where I would have ended up. I'd probably be the manager of Sears shoe department because Kia's no longer sells shoes. Kia's no longer exists.
Yeah. That's right.
That's true.
Clearly, things have worked out for the best. So,
yeah, that early encouragement, you know, people who say those things to kids don't even sometimes remember that they said it, but it is so important. It's great to hear you validate that.
That's exactly true.
Yeah, and as a you know, as a teacher myself, I'm always making sure that we're trying to reinforce the positive. Always trying to reinforce the positive.
I suggest an excellent policy.
Yeah. And ignore the negative is what we do.
So yeah. How much does your time in the service inform your creation of Swagger?
I've always said I got more out of the Army than got out of me. I was as unimpressive a soldier as I was a child. Maybe because they're almost the same. Anyway, I was not a particularly good soldier. And it turned out that the petty disciplines of the military were not a good fit for me. Being in the military taught me a lot of things about the way people interrelate, about the way offices work, about having to do what you don't want to do, about getting places on time and correctly dressed. And I do honestly think that too much has left. I think the draft really helped a lot of people, boys, men, young men of different classes, to interact and talk to each other and learn about each other. And discover that each guy was okay, you know. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how we've been helped by having gotten rid of the draft, but I understand that that's a minority position, and I also understand that the draft will never come back. And it's just, you know, 2 years in an illiberal institution helps anyone.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it helps to be around someone who, when you say, you know, I just don't feel like getting out of bed today, it helps to have someone in your life who says, Private, get your blank, blank, blank out of the blank, blank bunk and get over there at attention in 30 seconds starting now.
I can right. see
and
that.
Having
yeah.
that in your life, it's not a bad thing.
No.
It's not fun, but it's not a bad thing.
Yeah, I think,
I can see that.
Yeah, definitely. It certainly builds character and broadens your worldview, mm-hmm. for sure. I was curious, what was the experience like seeing your book Point of Impact made into a movie? Was that an enjoyable experience for you? Was it painful? What was it like?
Yes to all of them. It took a long time, and it went through deal after deal, and had every star in Hollywood attached to it. Then it had no star attached to it. Then somehow, miraculously, it came alive again. It did not deliver what it was expected to deliver. They treated me very well. I have to say I have no complaints about it. The movie did some things very, very well until we got to the ending. The ending that was based, it wasn't exactly, it was based on my ending in the book, was changed. It didn't work, they said. It didn't play in the previews. So they shot another ending that had nothing to do with the book. It may not have even been directed by the same director.
Wow.
They shot it literally a couple of weeks before the movie came out.
Man.
And in my opinion, it hurt the movie, but nobody cares. That was about the time when they stopped returning my call. And there are always, all writers have to understand, if they get involved with Hollywood, that there will come a time when the calls stop being returned. Hmm. And that was the time when my calls stopped being returned. And, you know, I have to say that the movie has had a second life on cable and DVD and Netflix. It's kept the character alive. I can't complain about it. The idea was that it would become, like it became a series of books, it would become a series of movies, and that didn't pan out.
Right.
And another thing that didn't pan out is the rights are all tied up with Paramount now to the character. So I don't know what's going to happen if there will be another Bob Lee Swagger movie. I wish there would. I think this book.
Oh, this book would make
a terrific movie.
That's the exactly same thought I had. It would make an amazing movie.
Yeah.
And why they don't get that is beyond me. I mean, I can't tell you how their minds work. They're of a different, they're such a different genetic spectrum that I can make no sense of it.
That's true.
Well, we're up against it. Really, thank you. I can't tell you how what a pleasure it's been to talk to you.
It's great. Yeah.
Really, really appreciate
your time. We're
big fans. I heard you guys laughing, and that makes me happy. So
yeah, we are big fans of yours. Fans of yours, Stephen Hunter.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it. Thanks
thank
a lot.
You.
Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Thank you.
The Inside Flap.
Okay, well, there you go. That was Stephen Hunter.
Yeah, well, such a pleasure to talk to him.
Yeah, he's quite a character.
Yeah.
So I want to tell you a little bit about his book, Game of Snipers, that I really, really enjoyed. And I meant when I said this is going to make a good movie, this would make a kick-ass movie. Yeah. So this is a thriller featuring Bob Lee Swagger, star of at least 10 other Stephen Hunter books. He's now a 72-year-old man.
Wow.
Yep, this former Marine is now currently living peacefully on his ranch in Idaho.
You know what I like?
Yes.
I like that he is the same age as his character.
I know, isn't that great?
A lot of writers will not really age their character. Their character lives in like limbo land.
That's right, yeah.
But Stephen Hunter's kind of doing it real time. It's interesting.
You got to love that.
I do like that.
So he's a former Marine. He's now currently living peacefully when a woman named Janet McDowell comes to him asking for his help to avenge the death of her son in Baghdad, who was killed by a sniper.
Mm.
Now, this is a mother. She was a stay-at-home mom, and here she is kind of Nancy Drew style trying to figure out in the Middle East.
That
she's getting
really good.
Beat up. She's getting tortured.
Oh
she's suffering
gosh.
All kinds of
now,
horrific things.
Now, was her
things.
Son, was he in the military?
Yeah, he was in the...
And was it an Iraqi sniper that she thinks took him out? Or was it an American sniper? Or am I spoiling things?
Well, let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Okay.
We'll leave it up to the reader to figure that one out.
Yeah.
All right. So she goes over there. No, she figures out the guy is this guy named Juba the Sniper, J-U-B-A, Juba the Sniper.
Creepy.
Right, and now she wants Bob to go to a small town in Syria and use his own special set of skills as a sniper himself to knock this guy Juba off his perch.
Yeah, right?
Yeah,
take him
like,
down.
Let's go, Bob, come on, get out of your ranch and get going. So Bob, you know, he's living a nice life there on his ranch. He's like, well, let me make a few phone calls. Let me meet with some people and see if I can help you out. But you know how it goes.
This would make a great movie with the woman character and then an older man.
No, she's a great character. Well, just like
Clint
Al Pacino,
too old, but you could have an older guy.
Well,
there's
I've
a
got
lot
some
of...
thoughts on that coming up.
Oh, you
up.
Do? Okay.
Bob's like Al Pacino in Godfather 3. You know, he wants to get out, but just when he gets out, they suck me back in. Right?
Okay.
So he gets sucked back into it, thankfully for the reader, because you want Bob the Nailer in there. So this book is an incredibly exciting cat and mouse affair. It covers continents. It reads as fast as a sniper's bullet. There are twists, there are turns in this one, and the more we find out about this Juba the Sniper guy and what's going on, and we do get chapters from his point of view too.
Do.
Oh yeah, and those are great. You know, we begin to realize that something maybe even bigger is at stake here. This book just ratchets up the suspense to a frenzied climax. There's red herrings along the way. I guess you'd call them a game of herrings.
Game
sniper herrings.
Yeah.
There are several frenetic action sequences. There's helicopters. There's a scene set in a mall. That's Ooh. Always great.
Yeah, those are good, the mall scenes. Yeah.
I could definitely see this as a great movie. I pictured.
Okay,
as,
tell me.
Well, we got for Juba the Sniper, I went with Benicio del Toro.
Oh, I love Benicio.
That guy is one of the best bad guys.
He's
ever.
One of my favorite people to watch on screen. I don't know if you
can't
that.
Take your eyes off of the guy.
No, and there's something magnetic, charismatic, always deadly, always like I'm not sure what he's going to do.
No, you don't.
I'm not sure what that actor is going to do. And that's Will why, I be that's uncomfortable? You know? Yes, he does it
in,
most likely.
He almost does it in a like a sympathetic way. Like you fall in love with him as you're watching him
as a bad
guy.
I don't know what
guy.
It is about. It's just magnetism.
He's so charismatic.
Whatever it is, he's got it.
So, for sure, in spades. For Bob Swagger, Bob the Nailer, I'm going to go with Tommy Lee Jones. I would love,
oh, I love
to
that.
See Tommy Lee Jones.
Oh, yeah.
I think I read that Stephen Hunter.
Oh, I love that.
Stephen Hunter wanted, who's the guy with the deep voice that guest starred as the park ranger on Parks and Rec?
Oh, what's I like him name? Too. Oh, he's so handsome. What the hell is his Sam Cooker. No,
Sam
Cook. Sam somebody.
Shoot. Anyway, I think he said that he envisioned that guy as Bob Lee Swagger. He'd be great too, but I would really love to see Tommy Lee Jones. He's got great chops and he's also incredibly. There it is. Sam Elliott.
Sam Elliott. Also, I have to say, you might find this surprising. He is so handsome, though.
No, I don't find that
he is
surprising
so
at all.
Handsome. Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yep.
Yeah.
For sure.
Man, ladies are going to flock. Although, I don't know how many women find, but I don't know if Benicio del Toro is attractive. He's just magnetic.
I don't know.
Yeah.
And then for Janet, give me Holly Hunter. Give me the feisty.
Your go-to is Holly
is
Hunter.
It really?
You need a different Holly. Yeah, but that's okay. That's your female, like, I need a feisty.
All right, she's my go. Well, maybe if not Holly Hunter, maybe like a, Cate Blanchett.
Ah, see there, I like that. You're expanding it. Yeah.
She, and she can do an American accent as we've seen before. So.
Oh, and Cate Blanchett.
Yeah, she'd be great. She'd kick some ass. Charlize Theron would be great, but a little too young. Too young, I think.
Maybe.
Yeah, I think it would help for her to be an older woman.
I don't know how old Charlize is. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, she just did that Mad Max movie. She seemed pretty
she did, didn't she? Yeah. Talk about stunning. Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, whoever's going to be there, it would make a great movie. If you are into guns, Hunter has all the techs and specs you could ever want about all the guns and all the ammo here. He goes into incredible detail about the specific ammunition.
Really?
The firepower, everything about the gun, the telescope.
He must have done a lot of research on that.
Unbelievable amount of research went
we
into this one.
We should have asked him about that.
Well, it was one of the questions, but you know, we just ran out of time.
Yeah,
I could have talked to him for an hour and a half.
I could have too. I really wish we had a better connection.
Yeah. It's a shame. Next time we'll have to, you know, next time we're in Baltimore, we'll just invite ourselves over to his house
for tea.
If you're not into guns, it's no problem. It's really it's the storyline and the narrative pull that drives this book home. It's great. Game of Snipers, Stephen Hunter. Check it out. Always exciting to talk to somebody from Baltimore, of course. And just having grown up and reading his reviews and being so heavily influenced in my cinematic experience.
There's like a weird thing of pride, even though we had nothing to do with it. Of like, oh, he's from Baltimore. Good for him. Yeah. He made it. He made
That's
it.
That's right. Yeah.
Is he still an Orioles fan?
Still an Orioles fan. Hanging in there. Hanging in there. All right. So let's get to it. It's time for the YA shout out.
Ah, yes.
Laura, what do you got for us this week?
This book is called Slated. It's by Terry Terry.
Terry Terry.
Isn't that a fun name? Terry Terry.
Her name is Terry Terry.
Isn't that awesome?
Spelled the same?
No.
No. Okay.
T-E-R-I and then Terry with a Y.
Ah, that is fun. I like
Isn't that fun?
If she was French, it could be. If she was French and a man, it could be T-H-I-E-R-R-Y.
Oh, yeah.
Terry.
That's true.
Yep.
So Sylvia read this book in seventh grade. This is set in a dystopian future. It has a female heroine.
A blue heron?
Heron. Okay. Whose mind has been erased and she's not sure why. It's a really exciting book. She liked it so much that I read it too, and I really enjoyed it.
Oh,
and I think this is a great book if you want to read something with your kid. This is a good one for them to read separately. You read it, and then you can talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good, solid book.
Cool.
It's a trilogy. So this one is a little bit like the book Divergent. If you've read or seen the movie and enjoyed it, you would like this book. It's very good. Slated by Terry Terry.
One thing I know about young adults, they love their dystopia.
Dystopian future, I think, honestly, I think Terry Terry wrote Sounds funny. Terry, that Terry. Wrote, I'm going to give her a credit, and she may not deserve it, but I think she did. I think she wrote like a thesis on dystopian novels and how they became popular in YA fiction after 9/11.
Really?
Yes, in particular for girls.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
How about that?
And I'd be kind of interested in reading it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Sounds great. Andrew is Googling that right now. He's putting that book on his list of Goodreads.
No, I was looking. I think there's an F. Paul Wilson book, The Terry.
Oh, there is.
There is, isn't there?
Yep, there sure is.
That's funny.
Okay, well, now it's time for some
book reviews.
And we'll get started with
Laura Medicus.
So I read Wanderers by Chuck Wendig. This is 782 glorious pages of apocalyptic fiction.
Don't they know it's the end of the world?
Aww.
Oh, yeah. That's going to be your theme
that's
music
my jam.
For every time.
That is my jam.
We all know one thing. Laura loves her apocalyptic fiction, so we've got a new theme song for you.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. I had this book on hold forever when I first heard about it. It just came out.
Mm-hmm. And, hot new book.
Yeah. And my palms are itching. I was so excited to get my hands on it. So this is glorious. So when I'm saying glorious, I'm not just saying that to be fun in this particular instance. It really is glorious.
Yes.
So if you are a fan of the world collapsing, if you're a fan of Stephen King's The Stand.
Who isn't a fan of the world collapsing?
If you are a fan of Seven Eves also, I think you will love this book.
Huh.
This is a detailed, Andrew, detailed. That's why I mentioned Seven Eves by Neal Stephenson. Because there's nanobots, there's details in here that you would like. Realistic account of how the world as we know it could end. So some books about the end of the world, they gloss over like the infrastructure and what would happen to our power and things like that.
Uh-huh.
This book doesn't. He explains it. He makes it seem real. It is detailed out. This is how it happens.
So this guy has done nothing but sat around and found a scientific explanation for how the world's going to end.
In his mind. I mean, he made up one, created one, and then basically made it real.
Right. I like it when they have that explanation.
Do you like that?
Do
you like the realistic? Uh-huh. Yeah. I don't care, quite honestly. This, I found, I don't care. You could tell me, we ran out of power because of this, and I'll buy it, and I'll keep reading.
Huh, okay.
And I think Nathan Lowell said it is, you know, it's fiction and you try to make it as realistic as possible. But to a certain extent, you have to suspend belief.
I mean, I agree.
You know.
Yeah.
You know, so
that's
it's
true.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it's nice when at least they make an attempt to explain how it happened.
I wouldn't think that I would like a detailed account, but I ate this up because I've read so many apocalyptic books.
What?
That
doesn't sound like you.
And most of them don't explain things, and I'm okay with that. I really am. But this book explained things, and I was like, oh, wow, this is happening.
Hmm. Now, to me, I think the fine line, it's like a fine wine, is do they make it a little bit believable. The little part of you is like, this could really happen.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. So honestly, because of those details, this could really happen in the back of my head. It made it all the more scary. And not like scary there's something under the bed, but scary like, oh my gosh. Yeah. So the book tells the story of the end of the world from the point of view of four different people. So it starts with a teenage girl. She leaves her family home and she starts walking. Just walking. There's no sign that she hears or sees anyone around her anymore. Her eyes are straight ahead. Her sister named Shanna. I pictured Shanna, a little Kristen Stewart-ish, Joey King-ish.
Okay.
Is freaked out. She stays with her sister.
So she's like a zombie.
Yes and no. Yeah, kind of like a zombie. And I know you're like, oh, but this is, you just told me it was real, really realistic. He explains this.
Oh.
And I know it sounds crazy and I'm not going to give anything away. He explained it in a way that I'm like, okay, I could buy that. So she stays with her. She keeps the pace. She enlists law enforcement. Her dad comes. Different things kind of happen. And then other walkers, other people start joining her sister. And the same thing. Just vacant, just walking, staring straight ahead.
Okay.
So they're the walkers. And the people, these family members, join the family that's left them, and they become known as the shepherds. So it's a group of people that are alive and awake and wondering what the hell's going on, and they're the shepherds. So while this weird event is taking place, we meet a doctor named Benji, who used to work for the CDC. So I picture Benji as Donald Glover, basically. It's exactly.
Oh,
I was
okay.
Like, oh, it's Donald Glover.
Not Danny Glover.
No, Donald okay. Glover. Right. He's young.
I like Donald Glover.
I do too. So he's brought in.
Childish Gambino.
Childish yes, Gambino. That's right. So he's brought in by a private company.
Andrew's looking around like we're speaking Japanese.
Do you know right who now. Donald Glover is, Andrew?
I believe Gambino. I do.
Oh, yeah.
But I have no idea who Childish Gambino is.
Oh. Donald Glover also created and starred in the TV show Atlanta.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I know who you mean. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he plays Simba in the new Lion King also.
Oh, really?
I think so. Mm-hmm. Anywho.
This guy.
Donald Glover gets brought in by a private company to meet an artificial intelligence that this company has developed. And this artificial intelligence is nicknamed Black Swan. Yes. Mm-hmm. Black Swan told the handlers that it specifically wanted to meet this guy, Benji.
This guy, Benji.
Benji is enlisted to help with the walkers. Black Swan says, get Benji.
All right.
Like, Benji can help. Creepy.
Well, right? Maybe because, you know, there was the old dog Benji, who maybe was like a herding dog. So.
No, Benji's the doctor's name. His name just happens to be Benji. I know, but I'm just saying. I don't think Chuck okay, had any. Right.
No.
Yeah.
No,
so Benji and Shauna, the girl who's walking with her sister, they're both like the likable, identifiable
right.
characters
uh-huh.
in the story.
Yep.
So they kind of ground the book.
Mm-hmm.
So there's another man. This is the third character. He's a preacher named Matthew Bird. He's living in the Bible Belt in our country. He starts preaching about these walkers, and he compares them in biblical terms to the apocalypse. He's stirring up the conservative right. He's being stirred up himself by a group of really nasty right-wing white supremacists.
I think it always adds an air of authenticity to any work of apocalypse when you've got a really religious guy or a preacher in there.
Yeah, there's a lot of biblical talk. There's a lot of the book of Revelations from Matthew Bird.
I like that stuff.
And there's a lot of this right-wing white supremacists who really don't believe in the Bible, but they're using Matthew as their instrument.
Okay.
As a mouthpiece, if you will.
Right.
It's very similar to what's going on in our country right now. And it's frightening about how real it seemed to me. So the last person that we follow in the book is an older rock star named Pete, probably similar in fame to someone like Billy Joe Armstrong from Green Day.
Ah, Billy Joel.
Mm-hmm.
Billy Joel.
No. Rock star, not a pop rock star.
Right.
So
a real, true rock star.
Pete finds some fame and some purpose with the walkers and the shepherds.
Mm-hmm.
He also gives a little bit of comic relief. He was one of my favorite characters.
Oh, so there is some comedy in this book.
I found it to be with Pete, honestly. Mm-hmm. I liked Pete an awful lot. I like that character. Other people might not.
It's a good name, Pete, for like your little comic relief. Mm-hmm. Pete, yep.
So
did anyone ever call him Pistol Pete at any point?
No. Huh. No. Okay. Pete got me into, now I'm listening to a lot of Willie Nelson. But anyway, if you read the book, you'll realize why.
Every time I walk in the house,
it's true. Like
Willie
really
Nelson
on.
Coming out of the Bluetooth speakers.
Yeah, so the novel is really current in terms of what's going on in Trump's America right
now. I get
now.
It. On the road again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
Yep.
Because the book is so current, I just found it incredibly frightening. It's realistic. And it's current. And it's not, again, it's not like the leave on the lights on frightening. It's more like you're going to lay awake at 3 a.m. and you're going to wonder what you can do to stop where the country's going and also where the world is going.
Mm. This sounds like a great book.
I've come up with nothing yet. So if anyone has any ideas, that would be great. So there's a lot of twists and turns in the story, and I really can't tell you much about the plot.
Twist.
If you're going to read it, don't read really too much description because it's going to be a spoiler. And there's a lot more to this book. It's 782 pages than what I'm telling you. It's a really sad, though. The undercurrent is sad and troubling about the unraveling of America.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great read, and it's the kind of book I think that people are going to remember years and years from now.
Wow. Now, you compare it to The Stand. Is this a horror book? Would you describe this as horror?
It is not horror in the supernatural aspect that Stephen King had in The Stand.
Oh, yeah. I guess
at
there
all.
Was a supernatural element to that.
This is horror. I don't know if I'd call it horror. It's really dystopian. I don't know. It's so current that you could call it horror because it's a horrific thing potentially that could happen. And also don't read this book with a cold. And you'll start, if you have a cold,
I don't know what that means.
Put the book aside and
well, you know, the
get
stand
better.
Started with a cold, I think, the mm-hmm. super flu.
That's true.
Captain Trips.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. All right. Not to give anything away, but while I was reading this book, I didn't feel very well, like off and on.
Oh, no.
And I really, like, it affected me a little bit. It got in my head. Yes, huh. Andrew.
So I'll never forget there's a Michael Crichton book.
Uh-huh.
And
detailed and
realistic.
They made
a movie. But what was the name of that movie? It was like Pandemic or something.
Oh,
like
yeah.
That, something like that.
Yeah.
Jurassic Park.
And so, but I remember seeing that film in the movie theater. Mm-hmm. And the film is about an epidemic or whatever. And
yeah.
So, but the scene shows people like in a movie theater getting sick.
Oh.
And here you are, you know, watching
yes.
this in the movie theater.
Oh, no.
Yes.
And you're just sitting there thinking,
I know.
Yeah.
I'm doomed.
Yeah. And it just adds a level. I mean, it's just one of those
it things.
It does.
That, it adds a level.
Yeah.
Yeah. In this book, too, we were traveling when I read it. And you know how communicable things are when you travel, especially. And I'm reading about something spreading.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking, oh my gosh.
Well, that's why they.
Getting sick.
When they show.
It's also gross. This book has some gross out elements.
Oh, yeah?
Like good gross out,
I like
if
that.
You're a fan of that. Yeah.
That's good.
Wait until your cold is gone.
You know, when they show the movie Rain Man, or when they used to show the movie Rain Man uh-huh. on airplanes, they'd cut out the whole scene where Dustin Hoffman explains to Tom Cruise. He lists
oh,
every
yeah.
airline and
I
how
remember
every
that.
Airline
Qantas.
Crashes.
Qantas.
Qantas never crashed. That's Qantas
right.
never crashed.
That's right.
So maybe they show that. I don't know. Maybe they should probably show that on Qantas Airlines, but
oh,
you know,
good point.
No other airlines
yeah.
gets it. All right, very good. So the name of that is
Wanderers
by
Chuck Wendig.
And that was recommended by
Laura Medicus.
All right, very good. So now it's time for my book. I am
Dave Medicus.
All right, so before I tell you the name of my book, now Laura knows what book I'm going to recommend, but Andrew, I'm going to give you
already.
A little audio clue. You already forgot.
I did.
Okay, that's right. I'm going to give you a little audio clue as to the subject matter of my book.
It, otherwise, he'll take himself over the top. He's so lucky to have a teammate, and I think he's waiting.
Well, Ulrich is now in first
waiting.
Place. I can't believe he will take advantage of this. He's looking over his shoulders. He knows there's a possibility of winning the Tour de France right now, but he's not
yeah,
sure what's
going
to happen.
Okay, here we go, yes. It is, there's a little classic clip for you from the Tour de France.
And I was pretty sure it was the Tour de France when I looked over and saw the label on the audio button that said Tour de France. But, yeah.
You're not
yeah.
supposed to look over at the iPad, for goodness sakes. All right. Well, yes, it's all about the Tour de France. The name of the book is called The Black Jersey. It's written by Jorge Zepeda Patterson. And I read this book, conveniently enough, while watching the Tour de France. For those of you who don't know, every July, my favorite time of year, where every morning I get to wake up, stroll into the living room with my cup of coffee, turn on NBC Sports, and just veg out with the Tour de France. It's the best thing about being a teacher. Summer's off. And it's like a 3-week tradition during July where you get to watch glorious, glorious, glorious hours and hours. You know, these telecasts, you know, how long is a football game?
Four hours.
About 3 hours. Yeah. Baseball game might go to 4 hours. Tour de France, these stages, some of them go 5-6 hours. It's a
it's
fantastic.
On. It is on, Andrew, all the time. It's background.
And
I actually... I'm not a person who, I don't really like having the TV on,
mm-hmm.
like when I'm home doing stuff. For whatever
right.
reason, I've never been that way. It's a little stressful. I actually have gotten used to the tour and I like it because the guys there have great Australian accents.
Yeah, we have Robbie McEwen.
And so I love hearing the Australian chatter in the background.
Yeah, and it's like a travelogue that you're looking up and you're just seeing these ancient castles, Roman
constant.
Ruins, the beautiful scenery of France. So it's like watching a travel show with an athletic endeavor in it, sprinkled in.
And the commentators are funny.
And they're funny, yes.
I think because they're Australian.
So the Dowd household's a little busy.
Uh-huh.
A 4-year-old, a 7-year-old, a 10-year-old, 2 dogs, 6 chickens. Now... I think next year I'd like to try an experiment.
Uh-huh.
I'd like to put the Tour de France on,
chickens.
Kick my feet up,
yes.
Start watching the Tour de France,
yes,
and then just wait for the commentary for my wife and my kids asking me, "What, Dad? What the heck are you watching?"
You might be surprised; they might enjoy it because it's the commentators are funny.
Yeah, well, the good news is, like, when I wake up...
The scenery's gorgeous, too.
It's usually about halfway through, because it starts... I mean, it starts at noon in France with, like, 4 or 5 in the morning here. So it starts halfway through. I get to watch half of it, and I'll read a book, you know, whatever, as I'm watching it, you know, just look back and forth. And then when the stage is over, here's the beauty... They pop on the replay immediately, so I click on over to the replay and watch the first half, and then just kind of have it on in the background for the for, you know, 5-6 hours.
For the rest of the day.
You got the post ceremony where they get up, the medal ceremony and all that. You know, I really get into it. Speaking of getting into it, I really got into this book. All right, let's talk about the book.
We're actually talking about a book. Oh my gosh.
So
the black jersey.
The black jersey. Okay. Now, do you know what they call the, you know what color the winner wears in the Tour de France? What color the jersey is, Andrew?
I believe it's yellow.
Yes, it is.
The jaune.
The maillot jaune, as they call it in France, or the yellow jersey. So this is the black jersey because there is a murderer running around the Tour de France, or I should say a murderer cycling around the Tour de France.
Not
so
running.
When this podcast airs, it will mark the end of the 106th Tour de France. We're recording this on Wednesday. So, and by the way, this tour, did you know, is one of the most exciting tours they've had in many, many years. There are at least, there's only 4 days of racing left. The 3 mountain stages, and there's at least 6 riders who could still win, and 2 of them are Frenchmen, which is really good news for the French, because a French rider has not won the Tour in 34 years. So they're very, very excited over
there. I bet.
My personal pick, of course, this might sound stupid because we're airing this on, I'll put it out there.
Okay.
My pick is...
Dave predicts the future.
Thibaut Pinot. So,
but Thibaut Pinot,
the Frenchman. Currently is not in first place, but he's right there. He's within striking distance.
Thibaut Pinot.
But you cannot discount last year's winner, Geraint Thomas, who's an Englishman who rides for Team Ineos, which is basically the New York Yankees of the tour. And you have, of course, Egan Bernal. I don't have to tell you, Andrew.
Andrew's eyes are rolling.
He's right there. And let's not forget about Julian Alaphilippe, who, you know, no one expected to be wearing the maillot jaune this year.
Oh,
and yet there the Frenchman sits right now in yellow.
So I'm wondering if the Tour de France this year is going to end like Jean Van de Velde. And so, this was a French golfer.
Oh, no. Yeah.
And he had an incredible lead in 1999. And I believe it was the
British Open.
The
British Open, yeah. And they just call it the Open, but yeah.
And I don't know the last time that a Frenchman actually had won like a major golfing event. So
I don't know if
everybody
ever.
In France turned on the TV.
Oh,
that's
no.
right.
This would be kind of
guy
being
a celebrity.
I don't know
anything about this.
And then he basically had a huge lead, and he had like an absolute historic meltdown.
Oh no!
Like. You know,
it's literally one of the biggest, they call it a choke job, one of the biggest collapses of all time in the history of sports.
You are kidding.
The 1999 Open at Carnoustie, or they call it Carnasty because it's an extremely difficult course. And of course, the British Open is always known for having tough courses. Let me see here. Oh, he had a 3-stroke lead on 18.
Yeah.
3-stroke lead on 18.
But basically the entire country tuned in, everybody thinking this guy's going to be a natural hero, that they tune in only to watch him
just choke.
Choke
and die.
In absolute epic fashion.
All he needed to win was a double bogey. He would have been the first French winner
painful.
Since 1907.
Is golf the only sport where an individual can... collapse in front of millions and millions of people?
I mean,
rather
the spotlight
than a
is
team?
Tremendous. Well, baseball, a guy could strike out.
Yeah, but you're still on a team.
Right. Well, tennis.
The Tour de France. I mean, becoming
Tour de France is a team.
Could be coming into Paris. It's down the home stretch. There's six French cyclists all neck and neck.
They're clinking their champagne.
And then one of the French cyclists wipes out, takes out all six of the French riders, and here comes the guy with the British flag on to victory.
Geraint Thomas. Well, here's what Van de Velde, listen to this, is the last hole. So you have 4 days of golf. This is the very, very last 18 holes every day. This is the very last hole. So he hit a grandstand. He knocked an approach into the rough.
Oh, my gosh.
No, no, no. The Barry Byrne. Then he had to get into the water.
Oh,
he was
no.
waiting. Here's a picture of him with his pants hiked up. Let me see. Where'd he go? His pants are hiked up around his knees because he had to. There he is.
Oh, that's sad.
Oh,
I can't
man.
Even really laugh at that. That's sad.
Had to hit it out of the water. Finally ended up getting a triple. No, wait a minute. He got a triple bogey. Then went to a playoff and ended up losing to Paul Lawrie. So he's a British guy.
So I guess he had his own Waterloo moment there.
Oh. Always bringing it back to ABBA.
It always comes back to ABBA.
Let's see what
with
you're
the
doing
Andrew.
There.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, what we're talking about here is the black jersey. So this is written by Jorge Zepeda Patterson. It came out in 2018. This is a murder mystery set during the Tour de France. And although definitely, if you are a cycling fan, you're really going to love this book, but you don't have to be a cycling fan. In fact, I feel reading this book will make you a fan of the Tour de France.
Wow.
Now, if you are a fan of the Tour and mysteries, then basically, I would have to say this is required reading
Excellent.
For you. The book is told in first-person point of view of this guy, the cyclist named Marc Moreau. Now, he's a French Colombian. So he's half French. His mother was Colombian. His father's French. He's a rider in the Tour who's riding alongside the favorite, an American, with the name of the very American name of Steve. Now, Steve is the guy with the million-dollar smile. He's got all the endorsements. He's American. He's won the Tour 5 times. He's going for a record 6th a Tour win because we can't now, you know, Lance Armstrong's record of 7 Tour de France's now no longer exist. If you go to Wikipedia, they're gone. They've stripped him of all his titles. So he doesn't have any that they don't count, unfortunately. So we think of that, whatever you will. Everybody was doping back then, but whatever. So
I know how Dave Medicus feels now.
So Mark is what is known in the world of cycling as a domestique. So each team is 9 riders, but only 1 leader. And everybody else works for the leader. All guts, no glory. And that's Mark's job. So he has to, his job is to, and all the domestiques on the team, they have to protect the leader, which is Steve. You protect him from the wind. You keep him safe. You make sure he doesn't fall off his bike on the way into Paris. You know, you surround him. You keep him up towards the front of the peloton so he's not involved in any crashes. You go back and fetch the water bottles from the team car. In fact, you give up your bike if he falls off his bike. All these jobs are given to the domestique.
So it really is a team sport.
Absolutely, yeah, it is a team sport. And this is the problem with Alaphilippe. Well, he has a very, very weak team. So heading into these last few days, a little worrisome for him. There's nobody.
Wait,
nobody
are we talking about the book now?
I wish so. And this is what kept happening to me as I kept getting confused between the real tour
and fiction
and the tour that was going on, because this place takes place, you know, every chapter is a different stage of the tour. So the Tour de France is 21 stages. This book is 21.
I don't think I've ever gotten fiction or reality
chapters, and I kept getting confused because at the end of every chapter he'd list the top 10 cyclists, and I'm like, "Well, where's Geraint Thomas?
Oh,
where's Julian Alaphilippe?" I'm like, no, that's a different. That's reality. So what happens is that there's a problem in the tour. There are more accidents than ever before. There's a mysterious suicide by one of the top riders. A bike wheel explodes at the top of a cliff while a guy is riding the bike. There's mysterious goings on, and it's clear that somebody is out to sabotage this tour. Now, because Mark has spent a little time in the military, the tour director, which is a funny little shadowy character, comes up to Mark and asks for his help to find out who is doing all this, these bad doings. And then it takes off from there. I absolutely love this book. Of course, having watched the tour for so long, all the cycling stuff in here, this is, I mean, it's like this guy rode in the tour. It rings very authentic. It's true. I felt like I was there at the tour.
So the book was a real tour de force, is what you're saying?
Oh, my. Yeah!
boy.
That's right. It was a real tour de force. It the great part of it, not only is there a mystery, so you're trying to figure out who the killer is, at the same time, you're wondering who's going to win the tour. Is it going to be Steve? Or perhaps, is it going to be Mark? You know, his girlfriend believed in him. She thought he had it in him, but now he's got a ride for Steve. Is he going to break out on his own, or is he going to remain the loyal teammate to Steve? Who knows? You got to read it to check it out. You know, it brought me back to the time, you know, Andrew, I went over to France. It was when my sister Kate had just had her baby Julia, so I went over to Amsterdam to visit then, and then popped over to France to check out a couple of stages of the tour. And I'll never forget, I always want to see a mountain stage, because, you know, they got the, when you see it on TV, you see all these fans, and it's the only sport in the world where you're literally so close to these athletes, you can slap them on the back. You can douse them with water. You scream right in their face as they're climbing up the mountain. You're right on top of them. And I wanted to get in the mix, right? So I found out one of the mountain stages, and the night before I drove up to the top of the mountain, it's dark, and I get up to the top of the mountain, sleep in my car, get up the next morning, and it's like a party on the side of the mountain. It was awesome. I ran down, like I ran like 5 miles down, turned around, and ran up the mountain just to kind of experience what is, and literally there's motorhomes on either side of this sheer drop off, you know, mountain walls. There's people out partying, living it up, write chalk white writing all over the wall. It's fantastic, really festive atmosphere. And I wanted to get a good spot. So I get up back up to the top at and it's steep. I mean, these roads, it's like running up a trail is how steep these roads are. So I get up to the top. I said, well, I want to get a good spot because I want to be right there to see the riders come up. And it was like Lance's, it was going to be his last tour. So I'm right there by the barrier. For some reason, I don't know why. I think I was kind of shy. I didn't go down to where there weren't any barriers and you could like really mix it up. I just stood by the barrier. And I also got there early because I didn't want to lose my place at the top of the barrier. Well, it turns out, no worries because I was there for about 4 hours. And it did not get very crowded, and I was there all by myself. Well, there were other people scattered around, but I could have certainly waited and mingled around a little bit. But anyway, I was there for about 4 hours because they start down the bottom, you know, and they end the tour at the top of the mountain. So they come up, and it was very exciting, and they had giant speakers broadcasting the tour. And all I kept hearing, this was the leaders of the tour were Alberto Contador and Andy Schleck. And they were battling head, because I know this because I was listening to the speaker and all I could hear was this French announcer's voice booming across the mountain. Look at me, Schleck, 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 Contador. And I really, all I knew was that Schleck and Contador were coming up. But they come up and they finish and everybody, and it was great to see. I saw Lance Armstrong go right by and screaming out Lance, whatever. And it was great to see, but I was like, damn, I wish I could have seen, you know, some of the action the 3 hours beforehand.
Yeah.
So I kind of wander around the corner at the top of this mountainside.
Oh, no.
Literally about 100 yards from where I was, around the corner. And I couldn't see it from where I was standing. A giant.
You are kidding.
A giant. Like a billboard-sized video screen that showed all the action. And they had, you know, people. They just, you know, every camera. It was the tour. It was the tour on the video screen right there as writers were finishing up. And, you know, all the festivities and booths. And I bought a T-shirt and all kinds of stuff like that. But, yeah, right around the corner. Oh. I could have been there the whole time watching the tour. Instead, I'm standing by a metal barrier listening to a French guy by myself.
Schleck and Contador.
I remember it was before the days of selfies, and I was trying to, this big digital camera, I was trying to take a picture of myself. And it's so embarrassing. I remember kind of trying to do it like real subtle, like, and I looked up and I saw two French guys across the way laughing at me.
Oh.
And rightfully so.
And rightfully so. I was like trying to get the one, there was a 1 kilometer to go banner right behind me,
sure,
with a
yeah.
red ribbon.
Yeah.
And I was trying to get that in the back. Oh, so, oh, so embarrassing. So
this is a sad day.
Yeah.
That's funny. Was the weather good at least?
The weather's beautiful.
Was
it beautiful
Avid Brothers weather?
Top, but there was not Avid Brothers weather.
There you
no,
go. So that's
beautiful.
Not all that bad.
Good times. But the book was great, brought back great memories. And, you know, if you're missing the tour, you want memories of the tour, go ahead and read The Black Jersey. Great mystery. Even if you, like I said, if you're not a fan of cycling, doesn't matter. I think it'll help you appreciate the sport. And check it out. The Black Jersey by Jorge Zepeda Patterson. So, speaking of cycling, let's wheel on over to
Andrew Dowd.
And, let's see what he's got for us today.
So it's funny how we do this, and we do not coordinate it.
No, we absolutely do not. We do not. Absolutely not at all.
And so the book that I reviewed is Red Shirts.
Oh, weird. You are kidding me.
I am not.
Come on.
No, Red Shirts by John Scalzi.
I kind of wish I coordinated on that, too.
You could have done like...
Darn it.
I don't know, Purple Sweater.
There's a lot of books out there that I would read that have yellow wrapped in blue water.
There you go.
Yeah.
So this is a book by John Scalzi, and so this book is not a serious science fiction book. It is a comedy. It is a parody of the Star Trek universe. And I think it does it very respectfully, right? It's not really making fun of Star Trek.
They say the sincerest form of flattery is imitation.
When I was in high school, there was a show on the public, the PBS broadcasting station in Maryland, called Red Dwarf, and it was a Star Trek parody, but it was a British story.
Red Dwarf. Now, Red Dwarf was the Tim Conway.
Did I say that wrong?
Tim Conway is dwarf. It's a Red Dwarf.
I apologize.
Hit the dwarf.
Yes. Excuse me.
So this book follows Ensign Andrew Dahl.
Oh,
same initials as yours truly.
Interesting.
And
Andrew
Dahl.
Andrew Dahl has just landed. Just landed a slot on the Intrepid.
Ah, yes, that's where you want to be.
Sweet.
And this is like the ship that goes out exploring.
Okay, it's the Enterprise.
Yep, gets into all these strange adventures. And so it doesn't take too long before Andrew starts to notice that there's some strange things. And apparently there's all these strange away missions.
Hmm.
And strangely enough, certain officers always survive the away missions.
Oh.
And
are there love interests as well?
There are actually some love interests.
Because that was a funny thing with Captain Kirk.
And there's even some interesting twists in terms of love interests.
That's funny.
And I don't want to give anything
That's
away.
Funny.
But it could only happen in a certain kind of universe. And maybe this love interest happens, maybe it doesn't. But just the... Let's say the juxtaposition of what happens sort of towards the end of the book is really a very hilarious, part of the book.
That's fun.
They love twists.
And so, you know, certain officers survive on away missions. Certain low-ranking crew members do not survive. And so Andrew gets into the ship. And he starts noticing, he starts noticing all these strange things. So one, he notices that, he's back in like this science area.
Mm-hmm.
And he noticed that whenever the captain or a senior officer shows up, everybody mysteriously disappears, and he's the only person left in the office. And he's like, what's going on here?
Huh.
And it turns out they've actually hooked up a surveillance system. And so
they know when the boss is coming by?
Yeah, when the boss is coming by, so they can all just...
Right.
Like,
smart.
Skedaddle.
They can all just disappear. And
That's
so,
funny.
You know, part of this is, and I look at the premise of this book, is you kind of look at the office, and the office is kind of like looking at... Well, what happens behind the scenes in an office, right? It's probably more closer to the truth than if you were looking at something from an executive's point of view.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so when you think about Star Trek and you think about the actual show, I mean, you've got Captain Kirk, you got Spock, and everything is from their point of view. But if you were really, if you were a low-ranking crew member on that ship, on Star Trek, how would you see these people dying off in all these strange, bizarre patterns? I mean, how would you react? I mean,
except the leads. Yeah.
What would the conversations be? how does the science work? And so that's what this book does, is it kind of looks at that premise. And Red Shirts basically talks about the things that people that wore red shirts in Star Trek. are more likely to die. And so one statistic I saw is
that's hilarious.
Is that 25 people with red shirts died on away missions, 10 people in gold shirts died, and 8 people in blue shirts died.
Wow.
Now, but I will tell you,
how many people wearing a black jersey die?
Yeah, I don't know. There's no
just one black jersey. Just one.
So there's a lot of controversy in terms of whether the whole red shirt shirts phenomenon is true or not. So if you Google it and you look it up, because a lot of people are like, well, it's true. A lot of people are like, well, it's not true. Mm-hmm. But I guess it depends on how you count it, and how you look at it. But that's what red shirts refers to, you know, in Star Trek or in that is the phenomenon that if you're wearing a red shirt, you're more likely to die. I mean, your characters.
Well, I think we could ask George Medicus. I think my father had every episode of Star Trek on VHS.
Oh, and really?
I'm sure he's seen them all about 25 times.
I grew
times,
up on
so he could
Star Trek.
Tell you.
Yeah.
No, I did as well. Yeah. But I think it's great. I mean, the overacting, from multiple characters. But it really was. It did create it created the genre.
Yeah.
I mean, right? I mean, it really, and the show almost didn't happen either. I mean, it just barely happened. And then.
Cultural phenomenon.
It was very low rated its first season.
Yeah. So, I mean, really amazing show. But I think this book pays homage to that. But again, it is really looking at, well, what's the perspective?
That's
fun. What's the perspective from the crew?
That's real fun.
And so, you know, and at what lengths will you do to survive? Because that's what's asking is, you know, what are you going to do to survive in this? And that's
how do you get that blue shirt on? That's what you got to do.
Got to get that blue shirt.
Yeah, if you can find the blue shirt is definitely the one to go with.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's all these strange premises.
Oh, I'm wearing a blue shirt right now.
Yeah. Lucky for
I've
you.
I've got the green. I don't, just the green shirt.
The green
isn't
shirt.
Even on the list. Oh. It's not even on the list. So I think I'm going to stick with the green shirt. And I.
Well, you got a lucky shamrock on your shirt, so you're fine.
Yeah. And so, you know, and there's all kinds of strange things. Like there's one officer whose wife died, and basically people see him, and it's kind of like a Yeti or a Bigfoot sighting.
Oh, when they see him?
When they see him. Yeah. It's like, you know, you may see a guy that hasn't shaved in 2 years.
Oh, that's funny, just wandering around.
And that guy apparently knows what's going on.
The intrepid.
You know, if you can find him. You know, so it's kind of like the Yeti setting. Huh. But the book is funny. It is fast-paced. You know, it is not a serious science fiction book. Hmm. You know, there's twists in this book. There's premise that only a universe like this could create. But the, you know, and it reads very fast. I mean, this is a book because once I started reading it, I couldn't put it down. But the book is Red Shirts by John Scalzi.
All right. And that was reviewed by
Andrew Dowd.
If you just Google the word red shirts, there is... Red shirt is a term used by fans and staff of Star Trek to refer partially to the characters who wear red Starfield shirts, uniforms. Huh. And these are characters who are expendable, quite often killed. And in great numbers. Wow. Sometimes in great numbers, yeah. I had no idea. That's hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, I only knew it from the, of course, a red shirt.
There's
a
word.
If you wear a red shirt in college, you sit out a year.
Like an Urban Dictionary kind of thing called red shirt.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
How about that?
I love that. Sounds like a great book.
And again, huge controversy in terms of whether the phenomenon is actually accurate or not.
It's a term, red shirt.
Where do you stand on the side of this one?
Hang on, Dave. Hang on. Term in which they call it a red shirt, and they use it in film that's that these characters might be red shirted.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yes.
So it's actually entered the lexicon.
It is a word.
How about that?
Yeah. I'm sorry, Dave. Go ahead.
All right. Andrew, do you find it that it is accurate or not?
It just depends on the statistics. It's all what you believe.
I think it's gotta be.
You can massage those statistics to back up your...
Man.
We'll just have to go back and watch every episode now, I guess.
A stock character in fiction who dies soon after being introduced.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right, well, speaking of dying off, let's go ahead.
Murder, She Wrote. Remember that show?
Yeah.
They would have stuff like that, too. I wonder if they had a little tell on that
That's
show.
That's right, yeah. I think if you dug deep on every show, you'd find something.
Yeah.
Some kind of recurring aspect to it.
That's pretty funny.
All right, let's get to our...
Audiobook of the Week!
So, the audiobook of the week I have for you right now is called... Now, listen, before I tell you the audiobook... Now, I've reviewed a lot of audiobooks on this show. Mm-hmm. I've recommended a lot of them.
Pretty much all except for two, right?
Once you go ahead, if you're out there listening, yes, that's correct. You need to sit down. You need to pull a chair up next to that speaker or put those headphones in a little bit tighter.
Okay.
Because I'm about to tell you a book. Now, listen, sometimes when you're reading a book, or in this case, listening to a book, in my case, and actually when I say sometimes, I mean very, 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 very rarely, when you're in the middle of the book and you get to realize that the book you are reading is destined to become a classic. Now, this happened to me while listening to this book. This is an instant classic. This is a book I cannot wait to read again and again and again. This is one of those books that as I was listening to it, I literally couldn't stop. I would look for chores to do so I could just keep listening to it. I was grabbing the dog like, you know, hey, Nelson, let's go. It's time to go for a walk. And he's looking at me like, hey, guy, it's 110 degrees outside. I'm not going anywhere. I'm like, I don't care. I got to find out what happens to
Dave
Barry.
Did put new siding on the home while he was listening to this book. And I was like, you know, actually, I didn't put two and two together.
No, you literally told me to stop. I'm
I was like,
no,
Dave,
I'm good.
It's 105 I'm out here. What are you doing? Just take a break.
Yeah. No.
Now, this could be a commercial for audiobooks. You know, I mean,
That's true.
I mean, you can get your house resided.
Our house is very clean when I have a good audiobook because I just want to keep cleaning.
So I can see, an Audible commercial. You get Lazy Joe sitting on the couch. Yeah. Then he discovers Audible. and the next thing you know, he's out. Doing landscaping.
That's true.
Renovating the house.
Yeah.
You know.
Because you want to, it's kind of hard to just sit there and listen. I get restless, so I can't just sit there and listen. Yeah. I can sit and read a book, obviously. Uh-huh. What are you going to do? Walk around reading it? No. That's stupid.
So Amazon,
but I got to be doing something when I'm listening.
So Amazon, you're welcome. You can send us the check.
That's right.
Us a check. No, I could not get enough of this book. The book is called Recursion. It is written by Blake Crouch. Colorado author, by the way.
Cool.
As we record from Littleton, Colorado.
I also want to point something out.
This guy lives somewhere out here in Colorado. Yeah. Yes.
I had heard about this book, Andrew.
Okay, here we go.
I had put it on hold. And then when it came in as the audiobook, I was like, oh, why would I put this on hold? It doesn't sound like a book like necessarily that's up my particular alley. Although when Dave told me about it, I do believe it is up my alley.
Mm-hmm. It's up anyone's
And then
alley.
I remembered I had put it on there because I thought Dave Medicus would like it. And so,
I have been reminding
Dave
this
whole week, you like that book that I found for you.
That's right.
And he hates it.
Yeah, I do. Because there's something to be said for discovering a book on your own and not being. In fact, literally wiped that memory out. But
and
hey,
I sensed that he hated it, so I keep reminding him.
Speaking of memories, though.
Good job, Lark.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of memories.
Sensed the weakness there, and I just kept going back in.
Yeah, okay. Can we get on with the review of the book?
Yes, go ahead.
No.
I'm sorry. Right. I'm going
to
stop talking.
You know, what you need to do is you need to have over a phone call so stuttering Dave right, will be intimidated.
Yeah, okay. He won't be intimidated unless there's somebody in the room with me that he does not know yet.
That's true. Yeah, we would need to get somebody, a neighbor or a
client
from
mine,
down the street
to
stand nearby.
Yeah.
Now, listen. Okay, speaking of memories, this book is about something called FMS, which stands for False Memory Syndrome. So you've got this New York City cop, Barry Sutton. He's investigating the strange disease that's infecting people, this FMS, this false memory syndrome. So what happens if you get afflicted with FMS, you suddenly, out of the blue, have complete memories from your life that never happened. You remember a wife you never had or a husband. Children you never had, places you've never been to, all these memories come rushing back to you from a life you never had.
Is this a real syndrome or is this a science fiction or fantasy syndrome?
Is this a made up syndrome? As far as I know, it's made up for the book.
Okay,
yeah,
I wasn't sure. I mean, there's like the man who mistook his wife for a hat.
Oh, I got you, yeah.
I mean, weird things happen to our brain.
As far as I know, this is a purely fictional disease.
Sorry.
I mean, people can have...
I know that's a dumb question, but I just wanted to say. There's weird things that happen to brains.
I got you. No, this is something that was happening to a lot of people. And what happens when you get this FMS, when you are afflicted with it, you go crazy because you're telling people these memories you have and they're like, well, that never happened to you, and it drives you insane.
Creepy.
And like 25% of the people, or maybe 10%, a certain number of them. They couldn't verify how many, but people would kill themselves. They would commit to jump off a building, shoot themselves, because they can't live with this these crazy memories that they have.
I think my wife has got this.
Catching my wife trying on my jeans.
Well, you know, maybe you need to get her some help. So you got that going on. You got this FMS going on with Barry trying to figure out what's going on in the New York City Cup. Meanwhile, in a parallel narrative, there's a scientist named Helena Smith. Now, she is working on a way to preserve memories for people who suffer from Alzheimer's. And in this case, it's her grandmother, and she wants to make sure that her grandmother is remembering, you know, her life.
Of course, she's
working on this machine that's going to help people preserve these memories. These two storylines going on. So let's pause for a second and take a listen to a clip from Recursion by Colorado's own Blake Crouch.
He decided what he would say riding up in the elevator, recalling his suicide training. Now, squarely in the moment, he feels less confident. The only thing he's sure of is that his feet are freezing. I know everything feels hopeless to you in this moment, but this is just a moment, and moments pass. Anne stares straight down the side of the building, 400 feet to the street below, her palms flat against the stone that has been weathered by decades of acid rain. All she would have to do is push off. He suspects she's walking herself through the motions, tiptoeing up to the thought of doing it, amassing that final head of steam. He notices she's shivering. "May I give you my jacket?" he asks. "I'm pretty sure you don't want to come any closer, detective." "Why is that?" "I have FMS. Barry resists the urge to run.
All right, so the readers just do an absolutely fantastic job. You've got John Lindstrom and Abby Crayton.
Nice.
Now, I have one little minor quibble.
What's your quibble?
Well, at the end of, you know, obviously Abby would read Helena's parts and John would read Barry's parts. So there was a section during one of Helena's chapters, and at the end of the chapter, it got very serious and it got kind of emotional and kind of nostalgic towards the end of it. And she's speaking in a very soft, and it ends in a very soft and gentle manner, like a dying whisper in the night.
Mm-hmm.
And then you hear book 5 from the man. And it really, really takes you out of the moment.
That's
funny. You just know that he has no idea how the last, he just has his sides. He's got his lines in front of him. He doesn't know how the last chapter ended.
Oh.
If it would have continued with the woman, she would have said
book five,
you know, but he's just charging right on. He just knows what he just read was probably about some gunfight or
That's
something.
That's hilarious.
Book 5. And I was like, whoa, easy.
That's really funny.
Look, I really, honestly, I cannot in any good conscience whatsoever tell you what happens in this book, because a lot of the joy is
you
just
discovering
it.
You already spoiled it for me. But honestly, the spoiler, Dave, that you told me made me want to read it.
Right. Like, I would say don't read too much about this book. You know, the less you know about it, the better, because it's just a real joy to discover the twists and turns in this. It is a mind-bending, brain-busting supernova of a book. It moves at warp speed, and really, it just has you at its mercy. It is, now, Andrew, it's science fiction. I would say it's science fiction, but it's also a love story at its heart. It's humorous. It's a character study. And you literally feel like you spend lifetimes with these characters and they become like family. It's absolutely amazing.
It sounds fantastic. He also, Blake Crouch, wrote Wayward Pines.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I think we've put those on hold. We looked for those in the library, so we're going to try to find those and put those on hold while we look for the e-books.
We're rushing out to the bookstore to buy them.
That's right.
Ignore Dave.
Absolutely. So watch out for those false memories. And I actually heard about this book from Lance Armstrong. Lance and I
were... You were kidding
me. No, we were cycling up the mountain up in Aspen.
Right,
and he told me all about
such
this
a
book.
Dummy.
And I was like, damn. No, I'm serious.
If I had those kind of false memories, maybe that would be good.
Yeah, until everyone keeps yelling at you that you're you know, full of it.
Yeah.
No, Lance told me all about it. George Hincapie agreed, and then we all went out and grabbed some lunch. It was great. It was a great time. Great time. I'm heading back up there after we finish wrap up this podcast.
And who are you married to?
Oh, you mean my wife, Blake Lively? Yeah, I'll be heading back up to see her.
Yeah, let Blake know I said hi.
I will. Okay, so that's our show for this week. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. This has been
The Inside Flap.
We hope you've had good time listening to us. If you have, please, please, please go ahead and subscribe on iTunes, whatever platform you listen to. Check us out on Twitter at The Inside Flap, Facebook, same, Instagram at The Inside Flap. And that's about it for this week. Thanks for listening. Thank you very much to Stephen Hunter. Great time talking to him. Check out his book, Game of Snipers. And that's going to do it for this week. We'll see you next week.
Let the rain kiss you. Let the rain beat upon your head with silver liquid drops. Let the rain sing you a lullaby. Langston Hughes.
Nice. Have a great week, everyone. We recommend Game of Snipers by Stephen Hunter, Wanderers by Chuck Wendig, The Black Jersey by Jorge Zepeda Patterson, and Red Shirts by John Scalzi. Audiobook of the Week is Recursion by Blake Crouch, narrated by John Lindstrom and Abby Creighton.
Not going to wear these shorts ever again.